This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In her new book, Julie Moyer Meservey borrows from the movie Field of Dreams and tells her readers, if you build it, they will come. Except she's not talking about building a ballpark necessarily, although I suppose she'd help you with that if that's what you want in your backyard. Moyer Meservey is a landscape designer based in Saxton's River. Her new book is called Landscaping, Ideas That Work. And Julie joins us today to help inspire those of us who have a jumble of weeds and overgrown plants in our yards and to offer more expert advice to people who have the wherewithal to actually do some landscaping of their own. Julie Moyer Meservey, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. What a treat to be here.
So you would help somebody build a replica ballpark, I suppose, if that's what they wanted, right?
If they really wanted it.
That's
maybe
landscaping.
A small one. Why not? Everything is. Anytime you touch the earth, it's a kind of landscaping that you're doing. And I think people are a little bit afraid sometimes, although maybe not so much in Vermont, to really get outside and get their hands dirty and know how to begin designing their backyards.
Well, just take us there. How do you begin? I mean, I was thinking about my own space today and thinking, I don't even know where to start.
Well, the big thing, of course, this year for all of us is that we've had so much cool weather and so much rain that the weeds have taken over the world, at least in my garden. I don't know about yours.
Oh, yeah.
So starting with the weeds might be a good idea. But then after that, how do you begin? And there are really two ways. One is to start with a little tiny corner. If you have nothing back there, and a lot of people have nothing in their backyards, just maybe one tree, you start in a little corner and build your confidence by making that little contemplative space in your own backyard just for you. Or you can start in a different way, which is the other sort of top down, which is, you know, start with a bigger plan and work your way down to the detail. And it really depends on your personality as to which one you feel more comfortable in doing.
Well, and in fact, when you talk about landscaping, you say that people have to really think about their own aesthetic and how they use their space before they get into landscaping and what they're actually putting there, because you want something that fits with your lifestyle.
That's right. And with your own and your family's sort of personality and what you hope to have happen there. You know, are you trying to create a very useful place for family to come and hang out and have dinners at night? Are you trying to create a million different little places to wander and paths to go to? Everyone's a little bit different. And then your aesthetic is really quite different, too. Some of us want a very formal, symmetrical, axial, kind of almost Versailles-like space. And others of us really want something that's more informal, asymmetric, and surprising. So people are all different.
So what, though, is your pitch for why this is important, why landscaping is of value? I mean, why not just make your indoor space something that fits with your lifestyle and just have a yard out there that you can look at?
Well, the reason is because we all really need to be in nature. And we're losing the ability to sort of understand that by the fascination that we all have with our screens. And there's so many screens in our lives.
So you're not talking about screen windows here.
I'm talking about screens on our iPhones and our tablets and our computers, our TVs. We're just inundated with a fascinating world that's a virtual world. And what landscaping does for us is it brings us back to the world of our reality, of nature, and in the place that we are right now. And especially when you get your hands dirty, you know, you can't do that online. It's still virtual. So I'm trying to almost bring our backyards and our front yards back to us as an antidote to the amount of time we spend in front of screens, children as well, of course.
We're talking today with Julie Moyer Meservey. Yes, it does make sense. We're talking about landscape design. And listeners, if you have a question for Julie, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post at vpr.net. If you're looking at your outside space and thinking, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do with the weeds? Or how do I take that kind of bland yard and do something? Or maybe you live in an urban environment and you have a very small outdoor space, perhaps even just a deck. How can you make that a contemplative space, an outdoor space that you want to be in? Julie can help. Again, our number 1-800-639-2211 or online at vpr.net. And Julie, you're talking about screens and trying to get people to think again about outside spaces and reality. The irony here that you have your own app that you've developed called Home Outside Palette, and people can download it for free in the iTunes store and elsewhere. And I've been playing around with it, and it allows you to kind of design your own space virtually before you get started moving earth.
That's right. What I'm trying to do is to make it fun, because I figure unless it's pleasurable, people are not going to try and design their own backyard. So let's make it fun. Let's make it easy. Let's make it on those screens that we're avoiding and bring them outside to actually put the two together, put the two worlds together, and make it free so that people feel really comfortable and actually trying it out and doing it. So that's really been one. And also, by the way, we live in Vermont.
Oh, yes.
And there is about, 6 or 7 months of winter at least, it feels like sometimes. So that really bringing people to us in this beautiful place we live virtually is also very helpful to me and to my studio and what we do there. We want to help people. We want to get them. We want to give them confidence that they too can design their own backyards. And one way to do it is to create an app that lets them play and mock up their space and send it to us to get our help.
People can send it and you'll critique it?
Yes, we will. It's called Ask the Expert, and it's a free service right now. We don't do too much because, you know, we don't want to overwhelm people. But we also created an online design service that sort of goes along with this that allows people to send us their measurements. We'll design for them and send them a design back. That costs something, actually. But what we're trying to do is just demystify the process of landscape design so that people start to do it themselves.
Well, and you said, you know, that process where you'll actually design somebody's space for real with actual measurements comes with a cost. And I think that cost is $800.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which you say is actually fairly economical for getting an actual design that you can then go work with. But for many of us, $800 just to get a design. And then you're talking, I mean, if you're talking stonework, that's so expensive.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to buy trees, fruit trees, those are expensive. I mean, who has the money for this?
Right. Well, I think you have to start small. And one of the things that, again, you can do is start with a plan and phase it over time. Buy the crabapple tree that you know where to put it now because you've thought about the whole master plan of your property. You know, start in that corner and put in burying bushes that you want to attract the birds, for instance. You don't have to do it all at once. I've been living in Vermont 10 years now, and little by little, I've been taking my place on and sort of turning it into the way I want it to be. But I am in no hurry because I know that every time I do one thing in the garden, I have to look at it closely and sort of freshly and say, okay, now what do I do? Was that idea I had before just the right idea, or should I tweak it a little bit? It's a constant state of artistry, in a sense, when you really look at your project, at your property that way, and fun.
Well, Julie, we have people who have some specific questions for you, so
great.
Let's get into them. We got a note about rainwater and flowing, and Kristen says, I've heard a bit about landscaping, which is designed for rainwater to flow away from the house in order to prevent basement flooding. Is this effective, and how would I go about finding a landscaper who's experienced in this?
Yes, that's a very important question after our crazy day yesterday with 3 inches of rain. Drainage away from the house is one of the most important things that anyone needs to do and check on it, you know, periodically to make sure it's working because you don't want water in your basement. And what's going on these days with sort of sustainable design in landscape design is that there are something called rain gardens that people are doing and rain barrels, and they're taking chains, putting them on their roofs, bringing that water down into a rain barrel and then using it as an irrigation technique in their backyards to water their plants. Or they're taking that positive drainage away from the house turning it into sort of a swale that they might put stones into, and then have lots of deep-rooted plants around so that you filter that water before it goes out into the street, into the storm sewer. So it does all sorts of good things all at the same time to make sure that you carefully work with drain into your basement.
Quick drop out there, but Julie, we've got you back. So if you're looking for a landscape, an actual landscape person who mm-hmm. can come in, a landscaper, and do this for you, are there tips that you have? I mean, you must work with landscapers or work with homeowners who are then working with the actual people on the ground.
Well, of course, talk to your neighbors to see who they use. You know, we're all in different parts of Vermont here, but certainly one thing is to find maybe more than a landscaper at that point that your caller was talking about is to find somebody who's a good excavator and grading, somebody who's really good at sculpting land and understands how to make sure that your land works in terms of its drainage. Landscape designers and landscape architects also understand that. So how you find them? Well, you go online, you look at their work. There's a wonderful site that people may know about called Houzz, H-O-U-Z-Z. And it's an online site that has many landscaping people, designers, and others, professionals from all over the country, but also in our particular area. And you can go and see their work right there and see what they do and whether it fits your aesthetic.
All right, let's go to Mia calling in from Barrie. Hi, Mia. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding my existing space. There's a lot of unwanted shrubbery and mostly weeds and things that some of it fairly deeply rooted. It's been there a long time. And I'd like to get rid of it and start over. And I'm wondering if you have any tips for how to clear the space and get a good start.
A really good question. Something like a yew, for instance, you know, they get so deeply rooted, so tangled.
Yew tree.
Very difficult to get them out. So often what we will do is find somebody with a little excavator, especially if it's a small property, that they can bring in and pull these out. You know, you can do them by hand. You can do them by shovel, but it would be a lot faster and easier if you have the access, and it really depends on that, to be able to use a small machine to get them out. And really what I would then do is sort of start over, make the soil friable again. And what that means is it has good compost material in it. It's got a good texture to it. And then you can either, if you want to plant grass again or put in more perennials in this case, maybe some annuals mixed in, maybe a mix of shrubs, trees, and perennials, and grasses, of course, which are wonderful in our landscapes. You know, start over and space them properly. So much information online these days to help us know how to do that so that we really start with the right size of space for that plant to grow into. Does that help, I hope?
Yeah, Mia, does that answer your questions there about clearing your land?
It does. Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mia. Let's go to Lee in Thetford. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You've mentioned a little bit that gardens are places where you can actually communicate with nature, and I would just like to encourage that point. I mean, our gardens have actually been taken away from nature, and many gardens, you know, although they're lovely, are very barren in terms of habitat. You know, they contain nothing but exotic plants that don't sustain our natural pollinators and wildlife very well. So I would encourage, you know, or I think it would be nice to think about using native plants and having plantings that are good for pollinators and good for birds. I mean, even shrubbery is great for birds, and so weedy patches are extremely good for birds, although I know we don't like them. So I just wanted to raise that
point. Goodly, yes. You're totally right. There's a wonderful man named Professor Doug Ptolemy, and you probably know him, Lee, who's written a book that's very important about the reason we need native plants in our landscapes is because native insects only will eat native shrubs, trees, and perennials. So, and birds need to be able to feed on insects. And so there's this sort of biodiverse cycle needs to happen. It cannot happen when we only plant something like a Japanese azalea or a Japanese maple. We actually need to go to our native trees, shrubs, and perennials. And what he suggests doing is not give up all the favorite exotic specimens that you love. Put them maybe near your house, right close up to your front door, but around the property, at the edges of the property, plant swaths of big, beautiful shrubs full and trees full of that are native plants, okay? So that you still get this flyway that the birds can see and come down and feed on the insects that are out there on these native plants. And if we all start to do that, we create this massive amount of native plants that will bring back our biodiverse needs to our natural habitat that's around us.
We've got a couple of questions, Julie, not about the birds, but about the bugs. And, you know, that is another factor of living in Vermont. You probably are going to have to put up with some mosquitoes. So Liz wants to know about pest control. She says, I have a large yard with several places for entertaining, including a fire pit for bonfires. We love to be outside, but the bugs can be prohibitive. I don't want to screen my entire yard, but sometimes we end up in the house when we have visitors over because the mosquitoes and flies can be so bad. And Charlia from Chester wants to know then, are there effective mosquito-repelling perennials that thrive in Vermont and can be planted around outdoor living and play spaces? And she also wonders about tick-repellent plants as well.
Those are all great questions. And ticks are, of course, the biggest scare right now for so many of us. Well, big questions. First of all, there are new – I should start with the fact that there are a couple things we use in our property. And one is that we have wonderful, more green and less toxic repellents that you can now put on. One of which is we have deer fly. We live on a beaver pond, and I'll tell you the deer fly have been terrible this summer. There are deer fly patches that you can put on the back of your cap, for instance, and they sort of capture them and they stop them from bothering you when you're outside. So that kind of small thing is very useful. Obviously, a screen porch, a screen house is useful. Then there are these contraptions that are out there that actually buzz the mosquitoes and zap them, so to speak. As far as plants go, that's a really good question. I don't know that there's any group of plants that would be big enough to really take over that the problem of lots of mosquitoes, especially in a wet year like today. But let me look into that and get back to you, Jane. I don't know the answer to that offhand.
But a lot of the spaces in your book, Landscaping Ideas That Work, are designed for people to spend time outdoors. So, I mean, that is something, I guess, that many of us who live in places with mosquitoes think about, like, how much time am I really going to spend, especially at dusk and
yes.
later?
And that's, of course, when you want to be out.
Right.
So the very best thing of all is to make yourself a very good screened area, little or big, whatever it might be. And just remember that when you do that, you need to make sure that you screen the floor of it as well, because, of course, those little critters will come right up through the spaces between anything that you have as well.
Sounds like a horror movie.
Pesky they are, yeah. They are. It's really tough. And, of course, in August, usually for us in Vermont, we finally get free of all of these things. But this year, that's not happening because of all the wet that we've had.
We're talking today with Julie Moyer Maservi. She's a landscape designer who lives in Westminster and works in Saxton's River. And she's offering advice for those of us who have hair-tugging questions about what to do with our outside spaces. So if you have one and you want to talk to Julie, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition to post a question. We're talking about anything from the tiniest of outdoor spaces to the biggest. It's all fair game. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Julie Moyer Maservi is a landscape designer based in Saxton's River. She's with us today talking about how to design your outside space for your lifestyle and family needs. And if you have a question about what to do with your yard, whether it's big or small, urban or rural, well-drained or wet, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page page at vpr.net. We got a note from Melissa who says, I've recently removed a large evergreen bush from under my living room bay window. Now I have a big space that needs filling. What sort of low-maintenance plant or plants might I put in there to fill the space? It's about 4 to 5 feet across and about 2 to 3 feet wide. Melissa says, I'm not opposed to evergreen bushes. This one just had very large branches and looked like it wanted to be a tree more than a tame planting.
Well, you know, I love nothing more than a dynamic focal point, okay? And by that, I mean something that's in motion that you can look from inside your house outside and find constantly exciting. So what would that be that would we could create for her to have a dynamic focal point close to her house like that? And one, well, there are a couple things that immediately come to mind, and one is a water basin that has a little bubbler in it that recirculates. And then around that, you could have some stones. You can have a small tree that arches over it, some birches, depending on, it sounds a little too small for that, and some beautiful grasses at its base, some Hakanakloa, depending on whether it's shady or sunny. Or you could have a whole bird garden there. You could have a feeder, which, you know, you constantly talk about dynamic focal points, bringing the birds to you so that you can enjoy them while you're inside is one of my favorite things to do in almost every garden we design.
So as I listen to you, I think that sounds wonderful. And I would like to go visit that at somebody else's house because I don't want to have to maintain something like that. So, I mean, even Melissa had said low maintenance plants are plants. So, Julie, do you think people need to take more time and actually do the weeding, do the maintenance that it's going to require to have this space, even for those of us who say, ugh, I'm too busy?
Well, the problem is that a garden, a landscape is always changing. It's growing or it's dying or it's doing something that requires your attention. Now, the first year that you plant something, if you plant the spacing correctly, it's going to be too small for the space. You're going to have to mulch it well. You're going to have to get any weeds that come in out. But by the second or third year, it should grow perfectly into itself, be self-maintaining for probably another, what, 5-6 years, and then all of a sudden you're going to have to go back and it'll be too big. So you'll have to start playing with it again. There's no such thing as a no-maintenance garden unless it's all stone. And even then, you know, some little bit of dirt will get in there and a weed will come up as well. So there's no such thing. There are certainly plants that grow faster, that spread better, that, you know, allow you not to have to think about it quite as much. But part of the deal is to get out there and enjoy it, too. Just don't make it too big if you have that feeling, you know, that it's we all have busy lives. And I know how you it's too hard sometimes to and overwhelming to think about getting outside. But just start and weed a little bit.
Jerry asks what to do for a ground cover on a 60 to 70 degree slope.
Wow. Up or down?
Doesn't say.
Well, it's really the same thing.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on which direction you're walking.
I'll tell you, though, think about this. It makes a big difference to you. If your house is looking out into a 60-degree slope, suddenly that becomes a kind of three-dimensional garden and space that becomes almost a work of art that you're looking at, say, from your living room window. I call it an upward slope. But if it's down, you're not even ever seeing it. You're looking over it to something else, and it's below you. So let's pretend it's the second one and you're not looking at it. Then really you can plant many, many things in there that will quickly spread. You could put in a field mix, depending on how big it is, and then only have to mow it occasionally or weed whack it. You could put in a whole host of different – you could make a juniper garden, for instance, which could be very beautiful. But it really depends on whether you're looking at it or not as to really what you want to put in there. I'm sorry to be so vague, but
well, yeah, I mean, it's hard. One of the things is you talk about, you know, you have to look at your individual space, look at the draining.
They're
look
all
at
different.
The, yeah.
Every space is different.
Well, let's go to Lynette, who's calling in from Greensboro Bend. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. Hi, Julie. I saw you when we were both young and probably starting in our careers. Saw you at Tower Hill Botanic Garden.
Good.
The year it opened. And back then, you had just come out with your book about gardening in the stages of life.
Oh,
and
yes,
That has stuck with me and has definitely inspired gardens that I have designed. And I just thought, I thought people might want to know about
that. Oh, thanks for asking, Lynette. This is an idea. It's a theory I came up with about the fact that there are what I was calling at the time archetypal, meaning very fundamental forms of space that we all love and long for in our own gardens. And so I wrote about this in The Inward Garden, one of my earlier books. And it's an idea that there are these seven spaces, and they go from the sea, which is a completely immersion space where you're completely surrounded by, like in a forest, or under the water, a cave where you're in a little hut where you feel comfortable and contemplative, a harbor where you feel like you're inside of some enclosing arms, as you are in a garden. The promontory, which is the edge condition, like a balcony or a balustrade. And then you have the island, which is sort of like the picnic blanket on the lawn. And the mountain, which is the high point, the treehouse that you sit up on and look down upon your land. And the sky, which is the sky itself, where you long to be up there and try and bring it into your garden through reflecting pools and other ways. So thanks for asking about that. It's a really interesting thing that I've been thinking about a long time, and my new book that I'm working on now will actually be all about that idea.
Hmm. Well, while we're thinking big and broad like that, you know, we've been talking about some, solutions for regular homes for a lot of us who are regular people. But can you just give us the fantasy, Julie? I mean, you've worked on a lot of high-end homes and a lot of big designs. I want you to describe, you know, the one with the fire pit and the outdoor grill and the seating and all of the nice stone that's arranged in some artful way. Give me a fantasy to just imagine that my home could be like.
Oh, well, we just finished one in not too far from where our studio is in Saxons River. That's a very, in Vermont, our biggest problem is that we have such beautiful landscapes already that our job as designers is to not mess them up. So we have this big, wonderful landscape looking over a huge area of hills beyond, up on a high slope, and where what we did was put in a place, a swimming pool and a little hut for changing. And, you know, it just sort of has all the amenities we all wish we could have. But the biggest thing it has is it's in Vermont with this beautiful, beautiful view. And so my job was to sort of sit it all down with beautiful stone walls. So you sort of step down into it. You look out to it. It all feels like a piece. And that's the artistry of what we do, is to try and make it look like it's always been there and always it wanted to be there from the start.
Mm. All right. I'm going to picture that tonight not all of my weeds. We got a note from Sally who says, my sunniest location is an east-facing section of the house, and I long to put in a small patio and a sunny garden there, but I don't know how close to the house I should plant the growing spaces. She says the house has a concrete foundation that has about 12 inches showing above the ground, and I'd really like to hide it. The external walls are wood clabbered, so I know I need to avoid moisture-trapping greenery. I'm not sure what to do with the zone right along the house, under the eaves, and behind the drip line of the roof.
Okay, that's a great question, and one most of us have. One thing that we like to do with that situation is right along the foundation of the house, whatever it might be, is we like to plant at least a 12 to a 15-inch border of drainage material and then stone over that, so that whatever happens, we are creating, you know, we're creating a way to keep the water away from the foundation and to bring it out into the garden. So that we start with that as a sort of stripe that goes along the edge of the house. And then from there, there's so much she can do. Probably because it's concrete, she does want to block that foundation. We don't really want to see concrete necessarily unless it's beautifully finished. So evergreen shrubs would be beautiful. I don't know where she is, but we can still grow rhododendron in our part of Vermont, in the southern part. Then they're evergreen and broadleafed, beautiful shrubs. There's some azaleas we can use that are that way. And then there are, you know, hosts of other things that we could put in there, including perennials. So really, it's a matter of finding evergreen material that's probably 2 to 3 feet high. Grasses would look beautiful, but they're not always going to cover. But when they do, they're fantastic. And it's a sunny spot, so it would be nice for them as well.
How about something like a spirea that changes color?
Spireas are wonderful. And what I love about them is they look sort of billowy when you plant them in groupings. They almost seem like they're a little hillside of a mini version of Vermont, you know, when you scrunch your eyes up. So I love billowy material like that, and they really are very satisfying for much of the year.
Let's go to Randy calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Randy. Go ahead.
Oh, hey. Hey, thanks, Jane and Julie. Hope you guys are doing well. Hey, I 20 years ago when I moved to my house, there were some trees on our property which we moved to the southwest of our house, and today they'd be considered invasive species Norwegian maples.
Oh, yes.
They've done a great job of shading the house in the summer, keeping the, you know, the cost of AC down. Luckily, we took down one of the trees because it was girdling. Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend as a good replacement, that something provides a nice full canopy but provides good shade in the summer but allows the sun in the winter?
Good. That's a great question. Did you say it was on the west, Randy?
Yeah, the southwest.
The southwest,
actually,
exactly.
I had a landscape architect actually put the stuff in 20
Perfect.
Years ago.
So, and that was just the right thing to do, except for the Norway maple part. We didn't know at that time that they were invasive, but they are. What Doug Ptolemy, my friend who's so wise about native materials, says is if you're going to plant one tree in your backyard and you need some space for this, it should be an oak. And that's because they attract insects and 350 species of them, not necessarily in a terrible way, but they attract them to feed them. So maybe what you should do, Randy, is plant a young oak, give it plenty of space. But what it'll do is let it grow up a little bit and then take your Norway maples down when it's big enough that it's starting to help give you the, as you say, the nice shade you get in summer, and then the sort of the summer, the solar gain that you want in winter.
We got a note from Mark who says, as a landscape contractor myself, I find the compelling need to integrate edibles and medicinals into a scheme. We've become disenfranchised from nature, and our greatest healing comes from recognizing that we are part of nature, and nature is part of us. And in Julie's book, Julie, you have places where you could have a border or a part of your garden, you know, part of your yard and your landscaping that's actually an edible garden, even if it's just leading into the house.
Absolutely.
I would love for you to talk just briefly about green roofs, speaking of being one with nature, and if that can actually work in Vermont, where it's going to be covered with snow for much of the year.
Yes, they can, but you really can't just retrofit any old roof. You really have to think about it from the start when you're doing, say, a new addition on your house. You need to be able to have the snow load factored into the soil load with the plant load, so that this is a heavy thing that you're creating. And after all these rains today or yesterday, you can imagine how heavy the soils would be on a green roof.
Yeah, because this is a roof that actually is growing. You've got plants on the top of it.
That's right, but there's also growing medium underneath it. It can be very light growing medium, but still you have to think about making sure that it's structurally sound. It's got a moisture proof barrier that will you know, keep everything from entering into your house. And I want to say about edibles, I'm so glad Mark brought that up. I'm just become a vegetable gardener since I've moved to Vermont, and there's nothing I love more than harvesting my own vegetables, and I get too much every year. I make it bigger and bigger, but it's just the most wonderful thing to do with your children, to do for yourself. A lot of work, but there's nothing more more wonderful than being in Vermont and going out this morning, and as I did, and harvested my beautiful broccolis for tonight. So,
Julie, before we let you go, just a couple of quick tips for people who don't have a lot of outdoor space, whether they are in a condo with just a patio or maybe just have a little bit of a front yard.
Yeah, do something. First of all, containers these days are a wonderful way to go. Self-watering containers on wheels that you can get at places like Gardener Supply. Wonderful. I have many of them on my deck. You can make a whole garden in those containers, move it around, and bring it in the winter and enjoy yourself. And use your front yard as a garden. It's not just a yard. It can be made beautiful.
Julie Moyer Maservi is a landscape designer based out of Saxton's River. Her new book is called Landscaping Ideas That Work, and some of those include things like, yeah, think about a great walkway into your home, a stone walkway, but keep in mind that you may have to shovel it in the winter in Vermont. So we're talking about practical ideas as well as some photos that are pretty beautiful if you just want to imagine what your space could look like. Julie, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Jane, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, VPR's Peter Hirschfeld joins us to explain the budget cuts legislators and the governor have been haggling over in Montpelier. We'll look at what's been on the chopping block and how these cuts might affect you coming up on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. News of a revenue downgrade last month prompted a rare midsummer budget crisis in Montpelier, and the legislature's Joint Fiscal Committee has been meeting all this week to figure out what to do about the $31 million shortfall created by the gloomier-than-expected revenue forecast. On Monday, Governor Peter Shumlin outlined his plan for closing the gap, but the proposal met with sharp resistance from advocates for the human service programs targeted by his plan. Here to talk with us more about the fiscal negotiations is VPR's Peter Hirschfeld. Hi, Pete.
Great to be with you, Jane.
So the governor unveiled this plan to solve the budget gap on Monday, and he made it clear beforehand that he wouldn't support raising taxes to fill the gap or raising the education fund. So where did he look for savings?
Peter Shumlin very much looked to minimize the impact on any single department or program by distributing these cuts over as wide a swath of state government as possible. The proposal involved well over 100 separate line items. He also looked for areas that wouldn't cause any immediate impact on anyone, and that included kind of continuing to do without in areas that government had gotten used to it, holding open vacant positions. There's 7 state trooper jobs, for example, at the Department of Safety that they will keep open for the remainder of the fiscal year. Organizations that had been given small budget increases back in May, remember it was only a few months ago now that legislators passed this budget, saw those increases revoked. That means that state colleges and the University of Vermont are not going to get the 1% increase that they had been counting on. There'll be some delays in the purchase of vehicles and other government equipment. They'll try to dial back on overtime. And then there are just scores of really tiny cuts that started to add up. Things like the Department of Libraries, for instance, saving $10,000 by not microfilming historical documents.
You know, something like that may be a little more palatable to people when they're thinking about the fact that these cuts have to be made. The governor had been saying that, you know, these cuts, nobody likes them, but they're not going to undermine the social safety net for vulnerable Vermonters, you know, when we're talking about basically photocopying type things. But not everybody thought that his cuts were actually preserving services for vulnerable Vermonters. Lawmakers held a public hearing on Tuesday to hear from people who would be hit by these reductions. And there were some pretty big concerns that came out in that meeting.
Yeah, you know, $31 million is $31 million. And in a state with a budget the size of Vermont's, you can't make that kind of cut without nicking some bones. And a good chunk of that money came out of Medicaid funding. And this is the pot of money that Vermont uses to meet the physical and mental health needs of the poorest residents in the state. Those cuts are especially consequential for what we call the designated agencies. And these are organizations like the Howard Center in Burlington or Washington County Mental Health. And these are the places that administer most of the community-based mental health and substance abuse programs on behalf of the Agency of Human Services. Now, all told, this is going to be about a $6 million cut in their overall budgets. That's out of a $370 million annual appropriation. So it's not a massive amount as a percentage, but these organizations say they're already underfunded, that really poor wage scales already make it difficult to keep people on the job, and that the programs that have been targeted for cuts include ones for people with things like severe and persistent mental illness. Hospitals made a lot of noise too. They are also going to get hit by this reduction in Medicaid reimbursement rates. They say they're all going to be passing those costs on to in the form of higher premiums to people that have private insurance. And they say, look, you know, if Peter Shumlin is resorting to cutting healthcare funding whenever bad revenue reports come along, then this really ought to intensify concerns about what happens if Vermont moves to a single-payer system and the financial capacity to pay for the state's medical costs becomes hostage to the ups and downs of revenue cycles.
And Pete, what you're talking about there, just those two examples are things that have been so high on Governor Shumlin's agenda. First of all, healthcare reform, but then also mental health. I mean, he spoke a lot after Tropical Storm Irene and the the closure of the state hospital about the designated agencies really being the focal point for making sure that we have mental health care spread out through the state. So those cuts really kind of illuminating. And lawmakers, when they took a look at them, returned to the statehouse on Wednesday, they actually formally rejected the governor's proposal, which they had to do if they weren't going to accept it whole cloth. But they did have a counteroffer ready to go. So what about the changes that they've made?
So the legislature back in May created a $4.5 million fund, and the money was designed to give the Shulman administration the ability to either convince IBM not to sell its Essex Junction chip-making plant or to induce whoever bought it to keep the facility running. Lawmakers took $1 million from that so-called enterprise fund and used it to offset reductions in a pair of programs for Vermonters with disabilities. They also restored some of the proposed cuts to a program that tries to help at-risk teens have a better go at becoming successful, independent adults. The cuts to Medicaid stuck, but advocates for vulnerable residents, they're not altogether happy by any means, but they seem to genuinely appreciate lawmakers' pushback in some of these areas, and also the governor's willingness to sacrifice a portion of this IBM fund that he really would have preferred leaving intact.
Okay, so maybe some of the people who are concerned about social services cuts have been mollified a bit by the lawmakers' decisions. What about the governor? Is he okay with what lawmakers have decided?
He'll take it. He doesn't love it. The governor is a guy that always likes to go with his first choice first. But, you know, he spent enough time in the legislature to learn the art of compromise. I think he knew he might not be getting everything he wanted. And I think everybody walks away with a sort of grudging acceptance of this compromise.
All right. So everything's going to go through and we'll see those cuts coming down the pike now as we move forward with this this year, Pete?
Yeah. You know, the fiscal year just began 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. The governor emphasized that it was really important that that lawmakers act as quickly as possible so that they could begin instituting these changes as early in the fiscal year as possible. That gives them more time to take effect. It gives the savings more time to accumulate, and it minimizes the number of areas that they have to go in order to crack that $31 million nut.
VPR's Capital Bureau will be keeping a close eye on these developments and more. Peter Hirschfeld, thank you very much for explaining them to us
today.
Thanks,
Jane.
And now it's time for your messages to Vermont Edition. VPR producer Rick Sengary joins me. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Jane. Yesterday, we discussed the life of the telecommuter. One of our listeners suggested that because the telecommuter doesn't burn fossil fuels to travel to work every day, telecommuting is a great solution for the environment.
Well, Jessica isn't so sure. She says telecommuting allows people to live far into remote places when before that wouldn't be possible. And furthermore, is an increased tax burden to Vermonters because we have to get broadband to these extreme locations.
Last week, we looked at the trend of makerspaces, which allow do-it-yourselfers a place to create, often using shared technology they'd never be able to purchase on their own.
Alana says, my husband enthusiastically jumped into the maker movement a few years ago with ham radio and electronics, and now our whole family is on board. My 7 and 4-year-old sons have their own makerspace in our house where they collect recycled materials and craft supplies to make stuff.
Kate is a teacher at the Moncton Central School, where she's involved in engaging 5th and 6th graders in the maker movement. She writes, one of the key sparks for this was one of my students' science fair projects last year. She learned about 3D printing prosthetic limbs and is now working with the Enable Network to help kids who need prosthetic hands.
How very cool. Yeah. Monday, we talked spices with Hank Kastner, who was a spice buyer for the largest spice company in the world for more than 3 decades. Whitney is a teacher at Lamoille Union High School and says spices can be educational tools. She says, I love the smell of cardamom and the histories of nutmeg. For the last 15 years, I've taught a modern world history course for students with a focus on the independent study of a commodity. The students tend to be so excited about their research and the mysteries behind the origin and movement of a spice or of cod or coffee or rubber.
And it's fair season in the state. We recently talked about whether county fairs are still a relevant part of the Vermont culture. That prompted Elizabeth to write, "Having grown up near New York City, it was wonderful for me to get to the Tunbridge Fair a few years ago and see all the animals. I had no previous experience with farm animals. I went into the big barn and I pet a calf. Was I amazed when he licked me? Of course, I knew dogs affectionately lick people, but who knew that calves do as well?"
A learning experience. We've also talked recently about whether or not Vermont is exceptional.
And we heard from a lot of you, including Charles. He says our diminutive population offers a couple of benefits. We are highly ranked in many quality of life standards, and that is because of our size. We're also ranked high on some negative qualities, but it is our small size that will allow us to tackle these problems with thoughtful solutions.
We also want to mention that there was an outpouring of support and sharing of stories when we tackled the issue of depression. Concerned Sister says, "One thing I worry about is the lack of psychiatry in Vermont, able to provide the attentive, careful medication monitoring that seems essential in using drugs to treat mental illness. It took years to get my family member a psychiatrist who was really working with him on monitoring the impact of drugs on his depression."
And we have a list of resources for people suffering from depression on the Vermont Edition page for that show at vpr.net.
And we'd like to hear your feedback on any show we do. Email vermontedition@vpr.net or connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition. I am at Jane Lindholm. Rick is on it as well. Thank you, Rick. What's your handle?
At Rick Singeri.
All right. Well, that's great. And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow on the program, Vermont Edition's first grammar show. We want to hear your grammar pet peeves. Mine is when people say less when they mean fewer. Rick, what's yours?
It's further, farther.
Further, farther. Okay, well, there are also questions about usage, punctuation, things that make writing difficult. You can ask all of your grammar questions now. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, or share your pet peeves with us. We're going to have a great time talking grammar tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.